In the name of Allah, dear brother and sister, Salam. You're listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, and in this episode, we're going to speak about the impact of social media on human interactions. Today is Tuesday, 11th of Jamadi al-Thani, 1447 of the Islamic solar Hijri calendar, 11th of Azar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 2nd of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For blessing these moments, for blessing our life and our time, this is the Holy Quran which helps us. Chapter Az-Zukhruf, verse 32, has a point. Let's learn.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Ahum yaqsimuna rahmata rabbik. Nahnu qasamna baynahum ma'ishatahum fil hayatid dunya. وَرَفَعْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَتَّخِذَ بَعْضُهُمْ بَعْضًا سُخْرِيًّا وَرَحْمَةُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ مِّمَّا يَجْمَعُونَ
Do they distribute the mercy of your Lord? It is we who have apportioned among them their livelihood in the life of this world, and have raised some of them above others in degrees of rank, that they may make use of one another for service. But the mercy of your Lord is better than whatever they accumulate.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Man is inclined towards social life, and managing differences may solely be carried out through cooperation, and had all people enjoyed the same faculties, opportunities, standards of life, and social status, the principle of cooperation and division of labor would lose their balance. Therefore, they are not supposed to be sneered by such differences and imagine that they are the standards of human values. Worldly possessions and social ranks are of no value against divine mercy and closeness to Allah. The impact of social media on human interactions is the topic of this episode of today's special. I invite you to listen to it. One particularly pernicious concern is whether time spent on social media is eating away at face-to-face time, a phenomenon known as social displacement. As Jeffrey Hall, PhD, says, this issue of displacement has gone on for more than 100 years. He's the director of the Relationships and Technology Lab at the University of Kansas. No matter what the technology is, says Hall, there is always a cultural belief that it's replacing face-to-face time with our close friends and family. In one study, participants kept a daily log of time spent doing 19 different activities during weeks when they were and were not asked to abstain from using social media. In the weeks when people abstained from social media, they spent more time working, cleaning, and doing household chores. However, during these same abstention periods, there was no difference in people's time spent socializing with their strongest social ties.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from series of today's special from Arab English Radio. This is your host, Alif. As for today, we're going to talk about how does social media affect human interaction. Still under global connectivity, we need to talk about support networks. Online communities and forums offer valuable support networks for individuals facing personal challenges, health issues, or professional dilemmas. These networks provide a space for users to share experiences, seek advice, and find emotional support. The moderation of these networks, often relying on a combination of human oversight and automated content filtering systems, plays a crucial role in maintaining a safe and supportive environment. But as for the challenges to traditional social interaction, we need to actually have a good focus on these changes. Despite its benefits, social media also presents several challenges to traditional forms of social interaction. The shift towards online communication can lead to a decline in face-to-face interactions, potentially impacting the development of essential social skills and emotional intelligence. So, how about the reduced face-to-face interaction? When we face this reduction in face-to-face interaction, we have to be cautious here. Again, excessive reliance on social media can reduce opportunities for in-person interactions, which are crucial for developing nonverbal communication skills, empathy, and emotional regulation. The lack of physical presence can also hinder the formation of deep, meaningful relationships. Studies suggest a correlation between heavy social media use and decreased engagement in offline social activities. Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
Dear brother and sister, you're listening to today's special under the topic of social media do's and don'ts. Don't feel the need to follow the crowd. Ice bucket challenges, smeared makeup selfies, show us your first Facebook picture. The list goes on and on. If you get nominated for something on social media, it's not a binding legal contract. If you don't want to get involved, that's absolutely fine. Do create a positive footprint. Everyone is always banging on about negative behavior online, but so many people use the internet for good. And we like that. Use your time online to get creative, write a blog, create a video showcase of your talents, or make the world a better place and raise some money for charity. Extra points if you can get adorable kids to help you spread your message.
Thank you.
Welcome here. This is today's special, which speaks about social interactions on social media. It's possible that one of the reasons people continue to use social media is the need to fill a void. But ironically, social media has created a new void in our lives through social comparison. As you disconnect more and more from life, you're going to feel more depressed and directionless. Being involved in social comparison impacts your self-esteem and your self-worth. By continuously engaging in other people's lives through social channels, we begin to compare our behind-the-scenes with their highlights reels, seeing only a filtered glimpse of their world and not the entire raw footage. Therefore, when we compare every aspect of ourselves, from relationships to body image, we feel more depressed and dip further into a false reality.
As for these interactions, what the impact on social skills and emotional intelligence? The shift towards online communication can have a significant impact on the development of social skills and emotional intelligence. The absence of nonverbal cues in online interactions can lead to misunderstanding and misinterpretations, while the emphasis on brevity and consciousness can hinder the development of effective communication skills. And what should we do for the decline in nonverbal communication skills? This is again another issue that we have to be a little bit sensitive and cautious about. Face-to-face interactions rely heavily on nonverbal cues such as body language, facial expressions, and tone of voice. These cues provide valuable information about the speaker's emotions, intentions, and attitudes. The absence of these cues in online interactions can make it difficult to accurately interpret messages and build rapport.
That was a very essential and interesting topic. So inshallah, we'll continue during these days. Tomorrow, be with us with the same topic. Thank you for listening. That was today's special from IRIB English Radio. And till then, fi amanillah.
So far from you, yet to me you were always so close. I wandered lost in the dark. I closed my eyes to all the signs you put in my way. I walked every day further and further away from you. Ooh, Allah, you brought me home. I thank you with every breath I take. You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning.
need forgiving. There's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me your hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need forgiving.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Dear brothers, dear sisters, picture this. You are standing in a long line at an office, for example. Someone walks past everyone else, slips some cash to the clerk, and gets their work done instantly. Some in the line are annoyed. Others think that's just how the world works. But the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, gave a stark warning about this. The one who gives a bribe and the one who takes it are both in the fire. It's short, direct, and it tells us something crucial. Corruption destroys not only societies, but also souls. Why does Islam treat bribery so severely? Because it poisons trust. A society cannot function if rules apply only to those who don't pay bribes. Justice collapses. People lose hope in fairness. Think about a student who studies hard but loses a scholarship to someone who bribed the committee. Or a patient who suffers because a hospital appointment was given to the one who paid extra. These aren't small injustices. They're betrayals that eat away at the fabric of community life. The Prophet's warning is not just about punishment in the hereafter, the afterlife. It's about the inevitable burning of societies when bribery becomes normal, like a norm. And modern research proves this point. The World Bank has identified corruption, especially bribery, as one of the main barriers to development worldwide. Countries with high bribery rates often suffer from weak education, poor healthcare, and slower economic growth. On a psychological level, studies show that corruption creates a culture of moral disengagement, where people justify wrong actions because everyone does it. Everyone does it. Over time, this erodes conscience. Erodes conscience. A 2016 study in the Journal of Business Ethics found that employees exposed to corrupt practices gradually become desensitized, accepting dishonesty as normal. In short, bribery doesn't just damage systems, it perhaps it reshapes minds and weakens the moral backbone of society. So how can we live by this teaching today? Refuse briberies, even if small. Corruption often starts with little favors. Saying no, even when it's inconvenient, protects your integrity and the society's. And seek lawful shortcuts. Lawful shortcuts. Instead of bribery, look for legitimate ways to speed up processes. Support accountability and teach children fairness. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by investigative journalist and author Matt Kennard. Matt is the co-author of Silent Coup, How Corporations Overthrew Democracy, and the author of two other acclaimed books. He used to be a staff writer at the Financial Times in New York, Washington, D.C., and London. He then served as a fellow and later director of the Center for Investigative Journalism in London, and he co-founded Declassified UK. He is now an independent journalist. Thank you very much for joining me today, Matt. I want to go straight into talking with you about Britain's active involvement, not just complicity, in the genocide that's being perpetrated in Gaza. In January 2024, you broke a story about how Britain had conducted 50 spy flights over Gaza in support of Israel. That number is now over 500. And you've continued to cover that issue, which until recently was totally not just ignored, but I would say covered up by the mainstream media. Before we get into how and why that mission has come to an end, could you give us a recap about what these spy flights are and what they were all about?
Yeah, well, as you say, these spy flights are the key component of UK support for Israel's genocide, which makes it active participation rather than complicity. Because, and this is not just me saying this, this is legal experts, if you are providing intelligence from over a territory being attacked by a genocidal power, you are a party to that conflict, and you're giving intelligence, which to this day we still don't know what that intelligence is, and we don't know what departments of the Israeli state they're providing it to. But these flights were announced in December 2023 by the Tory administration at that point. And it was just a government press release, and they did not say where they were going from, how long they were going to be in the sky, what plane would be used, or anything about it. And so I started looking on flight tracking websites and found where the plane was going from, which was RAF at Criterion, Cyprus, which I'd been working on up to that point anyway, because that's the key international site for all the international support for Israel in terms of arms supplies, spies being sent, logistic support since the genocide started and continues now. But anyway, so I started seeing these flights go, saw that they were Shadow R1 planes, which are intelligence, reconnaissance and surveillance planes, which can really get granular detail on the ground. And one of their main capabilities is target acquisition for military strikes. I saw they were going every day as well, and they'd basically gone every day up till about a week ago. And they're in the sky for 6 hours. One of those hours is getting to and from Gaza from RAF at Criterion, Cyprus. 5 hours over Gaza, just collecting intelligence. Now, we never knew what their flight path was over Gaza, because what happened was about halfway to Gaza, they turned the transponder off. Then on the way back, they turned the transponder back on. So there's massive amounts of secrecy around it, and also not just around the flights themselves, but around what intelligence is being collected and how it's being used by Israel. Because when they've had to defend it, the government, which is very little, because as you say, the mainstream media has barely covered it. In fact, they haven't covered it at all, really. But when they've had to defend it, when they've been asked questions in Parliament by MPs, who have, some of them have been quite dogged, all they say is, well, it's all to do with hostage rescue. And we only give intelligence to the relevant authorities. They never say what those relevant authorities are. But think about it. That's semantic wordplay. Israel characterizes their whole genocide as a hostage rescue operation. The relevant authorities for hostage rescue must be the occupation forces and their intelligence agencies, because they're the one leading the campaign. So I think we need much more will come out over the coming years. And hopefully, and this is why I believe that the ICC and the ICJ need to get involved, because the process of legal discovery would mean that we could get a lot of information that we can't as journalists, because we're talking about institutions and agencies within the UK state, which are the most secret parts of the UK state, the intelligence agencies, and they're not secret to defend us. Maybe there's a little bit of secrecy they need for their operations, but 95% of it is to defend themselves from us. All this stuff has been got from open source. There's been no actual whistleblower from within the program. So if you started scratching the surface, I'm sure it would completely unravel, and you'd find out that we have been for nearly 2 years just active participants in a very direct way. So it's hugely important. I mean, this is, and it goes to what you were saying about the media. I sometimes can't understand how it's just, and a few other journalists, but it's basically been me covering this story. There's no more serious crime than genocide that a state can commit. And when you're talking about our government actively participating in it, this should be like every journalist in the country that's covering this stuff should be going any avenue they can to get the information, and there's been nothing. And I think it goes to the heart of what the media in this country is for. We don't have a media in the sense of how it's commonly understood. What we have is a propaganda system. And Gaza has exposed that, I think, like never before. Gaza has exposed many, many different myths that we live by in this country and globally. But one of the biggest ones is that we have this crusading free press, fourth estate, which holds power to account. We don't at all. It operates 99% of the time as a arm of the state itself. And the other 1%, when they're actually doing critical stories, they're always surface scandals. They're nothing that tells you anything about the systematic workings of the British state. And definitely don't tell you anything about the secretive agencies, which have a lot of power in this country and are basically never covered. So, it's been a pretty eye-opening experience covering this stuff. And also, the other thing which I should mention is Spyfire is only one component. And there's obviously the arms that have been going. 150,000 bullets were sent to Israel soon after October 7th, when the genocide started. They've been sending armored tanks, all sorts of different military equipment. They also have sent parts for the F-35 plane, which became controversial recently because they, when Labour announced a partial suspension of arms to Israel in September 2024, they carved out the parts for the F-35 jet, which 15% of which is produced in the UK, which is absurd. Because how can you say, well, our lawyers have said that any weapons that go to Israel that can be used in Gaza run the risk of being used in violations of international humanitarian law, and leave out the part which is the parts for the main bit of technology which is carrying out that genocide. It doesn't make any sense on a legal terms. And in fact, there was a recent case which was lost insanely by two human rights groups to try and get the government to stop the F-35 parts. Anyway, then there's also the SAS, which again is not talked about at all. In fact, there was the only mention of the SAS in Gaza was in the mainstream media on October 27th. There was an article in The Sun, and this is how the SAS work. They're not against leaks, but they only do official leaks, and always there to present the SAS as this heroic institution. So in October 27th, 2023, there was an article in The Sun which was based on sources saying that the SAS had deployed to Cyprus for Gaza operations, heroic hostage rescue operations. Following day, a D-notice was sent out by the Ministry of Defence to all media to say you can't publish anything more about UK Special Forces in Gaza. To this day, there's not been a single bit of information which has come out in the media about what those Special Forces have been doing. I actually recently published that D-notice because I got a hold of it. Again, it goes back to the media point. I mean, what? And means they're complicit. If they have information, have received information about our Special Forces being involved in Israel or on the ground in Gaza, it's not preposterous to think that could have happened. And they've not published it because they've been told by the Ministry of Defence that there's a D-notice. They're complicit because the D-notice is officially voluntary. So there's not even any punitive... I mean, there might be sort of like unofficial punitive measures that can be taken against newspapers, but the fact that we've had no more information, the fact that they kept that D-notice secret, the D-notice I published for the first time had gone to every single media editor in the UK, and not one thought it would be the right moral thing to publicise it. The only way we knew about its existence was a socialist worker wrote a story about it. They didn't publish the D-notice itself, but that was a big service in itself. But so it's deep, deep complicity. I don't think you can think of the Gaza genocide as just an Israeli genocide. It's and I say this all the time, so I'm sure people are bored of hearing it, but it is a tripartite genocide. It's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel. Now, the US providing the vast majority of the arms, also Special Forces, by the way. It was reported early in the genocide that US Special Forces had been deployed to Israel. Britain providing the majority of the intelligence, it seems, or that's their role, and Israel getting it done because, and I'll finish with this, just on the spy flights where we started, subsequent to the work we were doing, there was an investigation by Al Jazeera into reconnaissance flights over Gaza. This came out last year, 2024. And they found that 47% of all reconnaissance flights over Gaza were flown by the RAF, which was more than double Israel itself. So how are you not a party to a conflict if that's the stats that have been gathered from open source intelligence? And the UK government admits they're giving that intelligence to Israel. They don't say what departments or what it's for, what apart from hostage rescue, but to me, there's no confusion. If we lived in a world which actually applied international law, UK ministers would be getting arrest warrants from the ICC now. And again, we talk a lot about Starmer and Lammy and John Healey, who's the defence secretary, but this also goes for the previous Conservative administration, who started the spy flights themselves. So Rishi Sunak, Grant Shapps, who was defence secretary, David Cameron, who was foreign secretary. So there's a whole coterie of war criminals that have served in the UK government and been complicit in, and participants, in fact, in one of the worst crimes in modern history, maybe in all history. So it's going to take years of work to unravel the reality of what's happening, because, as I say, what we know now is the result of independent journalists using mostly open source stuff. So as soon as, over the years, when we get more whistleblowers, when we get more information, hopefully from legal cases and other avenues, we'll get a much more full understanding. And that's why I always say, like, this won't stop when the genocide finishes. This is years of work that we're all going to be dedicated to, because we have to hold the people that are accountable for this to justice, because if we don't, then we just accept that we live in a genocidal world and the law of the jungle rules, and we can't accept that. So it's imperative to stop it happening again, but also just to stop the complete disintegration of our society, that we hold accountable the people that did this. And obviously, we have some hope in the ICC arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, because although they took too long, that's the first time Western leaders have been, or and our allies have been prosecuted, despite us being the most violent and war criminal countries in the world. So the fact that that threshold was crossed means that the idea that our own prime minister or the US president, or on behalf of the US president, because they're not part of the SEC, but, you know, the people that we assume, and people would be shocked if you said they're going to be in the restaurant, we need to change that idea, and we need to say, we need to understand that the ICC was essentially created as an imperial tool, and it was created to go after official enemies, which is what it did up to the Gaza genocide.
I agree completely on that, and of course we praise you for the work that you've done in exposing all of this. I think because of your doggedness in pursuing the government on these sorts of matters, you were even blacklisted at one point by the UK Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, that was earlier on at Declassified. That was actually a very salutary tale of how the media system worked. That happened like about a year into us founding Declassified. And I did a story basically about how MI5 and MI6 were training spies from some of the worst dictatorships in the world, like the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, you know, at a base called Chick Sands just outside London. And like always, I contacted the MOD for comment, because it was an MOD course that they were training them on, and they just didn't respond. And then I called them and they said, we'll get back to you, and they didn't respond. So I was very like, sort of like, they never do this, this is the first time this has happened. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a protest by Ahmed Al-Batati. I don't know if you remember him.
Yes.
He was a Yemeni soldier. Oh, sorry, he's a British soldier, but British Yemeni, who was serving in the Ministry of Defence and went out in his fatigues outside the Ministry of Defence and blew a whistle every minute to symbolise how many Yemenis were dying because of the British war in Yemen, which it was a British war. It wasn't just a Saudi war. He got arrested by military police and then discharged. But anyway, when he was taken in, Phil Miller, my colleague, contacted the Ministry of Defence for comment about what had happened to him, what the process was, and they didn't get back to him. And then he called them again, and he was recording the call, and the officer and the press officer said, oh, we don't deal with your publication anymore. Which is a contravention of the civil service code, by the way, because you're meant to, you have to interact with all journalists despite their political affiliations or style of journalism. And then they probably thought, well, this is a small website, nothing's going to happen. But it escalated, and a Council of Europe media alert was sent out, level two, which is quite a big deal, and also means, because the Council of Europe, the UK's part of, meant that the Ministry of Defence had to respond. So anyway, Ben Wallace, who was then Defence Secretary, ordered a inquiry, which was carried out by Tony Blair's former spokesperson, not Alistair Campbell, another one. And he published a report which showed essentially that we'd been blacklisted, but yet Ben Wallace still didn't accept that there was a blacklisting in his place. He said it appeared to many people in the press office that it was a blacklisting. It was just like legalese. But the interesting thing was he that whole report, which was quite shocking, by the way, it was like anonymous military officers said we need to put them on a list of hostile media organizations. You don't know what that means within the context. So they published that report, which was a long report, very, very shocking and worrying for the free press. Ben Wallace gets up in the House of Commons, apologizes to the Declassified UK, which is kind of unprecedented. And still to this day, not a single word about it has ever appeared in the mainstream media, which is crazy. Because when you talk about that level of response, like you would imagine, and the Council of Europe, you expect that the mainstream media, who you would think would defend fellow journalists who are actually doing proper work, unlike them, they didn't. But that was, again, it goes to show that the Ministry of Defence just did not know how to deal with journalists who, I mean, and they still are, don't take any state or corporate funding, completely independent, not working for any hostile powers or anything. But they just couldn't accept journalists, or didn't understand journalists that were asking questions in a critical way to try and find out information that the government didn't want out. Like, literally, if you look at the main defence correspondents from, like, Jonathan Beale at the BBC, Deborah Haynes at Sky News, nearly everything they publish is just a reworded MOD press release. It's shocking.
Well, Jonathan Beale recently decried the reporting on these spy flights. I think he attacked Des Friedman and also maybe John McAvoy at Declassified for reporting on it. And he asked, I'm paraphrasing, whether they had access to some secretive privileged information. And it's like, well, this is all publicly sourced. If you're doing your job, you'd have also discovered this.
It's a mindset. That's the interesting thing. That's my take on a propaganda system. It's not that he is being controlled. It's just that he has not ever got in his head an idea that he wants to find that information that the government doesn't want out. Because he's so immersed in that mainstream media world, especially at the BBC, where you're just an appendage of the state, that the thought to actually maybe do a bit of independent research never crosses his mind. It's that Noam Chomsky interview with Andrew Marr, you know, when Andrew Marr says, do you believe I don't think what I say? And he said, no, you think what you say, but you wouldn't be where you are if you thought any different. So anyone who does critical journalism gets filtered out way before they get to the level of Jonathan Beale. And that's the way it works. And that's why and that's why it's quite funny when they respond like that, because they're not aware of it. They always say, well, I can write what I want and I can do what I want. It's like, well, that's because you never say anything that the state doesn't like. If you did, you'd soon find out that they wouldn't allow you to continue. But but as you say, I mean, you said active participants. I'd say they're complicit, definitely, because if you, like, to go back to the F-35 September 2024 suspensions by Labour, right, that only happened because when the media has focused on UK role, it's always on arms, which is good. Like, obviously, I think there should be a complete arms embargo. There should have been one a long time ago. But the government was pressured by that media pressure and mainstream media pressure. If the mainstream media had borne that pressure on the spy flights, they would have been grounded a year ago or more.
Well, also, just speaking of complicity, you recently broke a story that numerous Israeli jets have been active in perpetrating the Gaza genocide have been landing in Britain.
Yeah, mad. Not picked up at all by the mainstream media, as it never is. But yeah, that's active participation, because these are Israeli tankers. They're called Reem air-to-air refueling planes. Yeah, they landed at Bryce Norton 9 times. At least, that's what we could find. I'm sure there's more. But they landed at RF Bryce Norton, all under the Labour government. And then days later, on some occasions, they were flying off Gaza, refueling fighter jets, when there were massacres of nearly 100 people in one in Beit Lahia. And it just got, and then recently, the head of the Israeli Air Force came and attended the air tattoo at a UK military base. This is a guy that is basically the architect of, in terms of the air war, of the genocide, and he's been welcomed by the Labour government. It is astounding, the level of complicity and participation. And it goes to the fact that I think that effectively we are occupied by the Israeli state in many ways through different mechanisms. One is the official Israel lobby, like the Israeli embassy and its various different agencies, but also through the groups they have within our political system, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, which are front groups for the embassy, both of whom don't reveal their funders. But, you know, in that Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, Michael Rubin, who was then the parliamentary officer for the LFI, was recorded outside a pub saying, well, we work closely with the embassy and they send us things to say when there's trouble for Israel. So effectively, every statement you see posted by LFI is probably drafted by the Israeli embassy, highly likely. That's one section. Then there's the other section, which is nominally Jewish groups that are meant to represent Jewish interests or Jewish communal interests that have been infiltrated by the Israeli embassy and the Zionist movement and made to work, like the Jewish labor movement. There's not hard evidence of links to the embassy, although Ella Rose was at the Israeli embassy and then became head of Jewish labor movement, I think. But it's clear from their statements that they're basically operating as an Israel lobby group. The same with the
Even in the Jewish labor movement constitution, they're bound to support Israel.
Exactly. Yeah, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews, right, which is again presents itself as a Jewish communal group representing the community in Britain. It's explicitly an Israel lobby group, because if you look at the parliamentary records of ministers' meetings, they say the Board of Deputies is coming in, and what do they say they're talking about? Israel-Palestine, and they're arguing the case for Israel. It's see-through. So you've got that element as well. And then you've got the media that is smear, and that these organizations play a role. But the other way that we're occupied is there's various mechanisms that can be used to stop the ascent of a leader who might take decisions which are to the detriment of Israel, which we saw very clearly with Jeremy Corbyn. And he gets criticized for not being radical enough on his Israel policy, which, fair enough, I agree with that. But in both manifestos, he said there would be an arms embargo on Israel in terms of weapons that could be used in human rights violations against Palestinians. Like, that was completely unprecedented. I don't think it ever appeared in the mainstream. And how was he destroyed? One of the main mechanisms was that the bogus anti-Semitism campaign, which began as soon as he was elected leader. Before that. And actually, Ed Miliband, who was the leader before Corbyn, he also came under, so, because he wanted to recognize Palestine. People forget this whole episode. And there was a whole fake anti-Semitism thing around him as well. So there's various mechanisms, which mean it's very, very hard, in fact, maybe impossible, for the British state and its different agencies, like the military, to put a hand up and say, no, it's Israel. And that's just the proof's in the pudding. If we're inviting a guy who's the head of the Air Force, when his boss, the Prime Minister, has an ICC arrest warrant out to the UK to talk for meetings, that something's wrong. If we're allowing the Israeli planes that are involved in the bombing of Gaza, which has been orchestrated by a Prime Minister who's got an ICC arrest warrant out, how that doesn't make sense in any way, unless to say that the British state is not acting in its own interest or in our interest. It goes, I mean, there's another example I've looked into, which is the prescription thing, right? Prescription of Palestine action was pushed by the Israel lobby. Prescription of Hezbollah was pushed by the Israel lobby. Both those things, I think, if even the British establishment had control over the things, wouldn't have done. One, because Palestine action is so preposterous, it's just, it's become unworkable and it's an embarrassment now. On the Hezbollah thing, they got two ministers in the Lebanese government. The British government don't want to, in terms of British national interest, they don't want to alienate and make it impossible to negotiate, to deal with people in positions of power
This is why I think, you know, Britain has lost a lot of its diplomatic capital around the world, particularly through this prescription regime, which is why global diplomacy now doesn't happen out of London, it happens out of Doha in Qatar.
To be
Welcome, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. After that, we have Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions about children and adolescents and their upbringing. Israel Watch will follow next. The program aims to examine and criticize reports and analysis by Israeli media on current events and issues in West Asia region. And the Ocean of Dua is our final program this hour. The program gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. Stay with us for the next hour.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا.
القرآن نور وبيان. القرآن هدي الإيمان. القرآن مسك الختام.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to this episode of Let's Recite the Quran. My name is Brother Muhammad, and with me in the studio we have Brother Masoom, Brother Hassan and Hussein, and we're missing Ali. Wherever you are, Brother Ali, we miss you a lot in the studio, in this episode at least. Inshallah, in this episode we will be continuing the recitation of Surah Al-Ma'arij, chapter number 70 of the Noble Qur'an, from verse number 21 of this chapter. I'll ask Brother Masoom to kindly recite for us the first three verses of this episode, verses number 21, 22, and 23 for us. Brother Masoom, Bismillah.
Sure. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وإذا مسه الخير منوعا إلا المصلين الذين هم على صلاتهم دائمون.
أحسنتم. A very beautiful recitation. I want to point out at the first verse the letters of تفخيم. الخير خير خا and
ra.
Both of them. Ra is always a letter of tafkheem, only in some special cases that it does not do tarqeem. We do not apply tafkheem on that. And what cases are those?
If ra is assigned with kasra.
Yes. So either ra is assigned a kasra, or the letter before it has a kasra and ra itself has a sukoon. When ra is sakin and the letter before it has a kasra, or when it itself has a kasra, we do it with tarqiq. We flatten the voice. However, in most cases, ra, whether it fatha or dhamma, we always go for tafkheem, a heavy and a rounded voice. وَإِذَا مَسَّهُ الْخَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. And if we did not do tafkheem, it would have sounded something like this. وَإِذَا مَسَّهُ الْخَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. Do you see the difference, right? It's flattened. خَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. Yes. خَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. But with تفخيم, the correct recitation, it will be خَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. Correct? And also at the end of this verse, we have مَنُوعًا. If we were to join verse number 21 and 22, how would you recite, Brother Masoom?
الخير منوعا إلا المصلين.
أحسنتم. So there is no form of إدغام or إخفاء involved. The noon of the تنوين is just إظهار, because the letter that follows it is a normal letter, a letter that is not a mouth letter, nor is it one of the يرمنون letters. So there is no غنى, no إدغام, no إخفاء. منوعا إلا المصلين. Right? الذين هم على صلاتهم. صلاتهم تفخيم letter, right?
نائمون. What kind of a stretch or mad is this, Brother Masoom?
It's a compulsory one.
It's a compulsory one, and it's...
It has six counts.
Exactly, six counts. دائمون. Keep in mind that Hamza has a cutting sound. دائمون.
Mm-hmm.
Right? أحسنتم.
وإذا مسه الخير منوعا.
And when good touches him, withholding of it.
إلا المصلين.
Except the observers of prayer.
الذين هم على صلاتهم دائمون.
Those who are constant in their prayer.
Brother Hassan, can you please recite for us verses number 24 and 25 for us of Surah Al-Ma'arij?
والذين في أموالهم حق معلوم للسائل والمحروم.
أحسنتم. Beautiful. There are two meds I want to bring your attention to, Brother Hassan. In verse number 24, we have في أموالهم, right? And verse number 25, we have للسائل والمحروم, right? للسائل في أموالهم. Tell me, what is the difference between these two meds?
Both of them, I think they're jaiz.
Keep in mind that a jaiz is usually not in one word. They're usually in two different words. Like في أموالهم, في is one word, أموالهم is the next one. Usually med is when we have like a stretch and there is a hamza afterwards. That's where we have the med. Now, if it is in one word, it is always wajib. You have to make sure that you give up to six beats for that, six counts for that med. For example, in this case, we have sa'il. It's in one word. Yes. So it's wajib and it's also muttasil. لِسَّائِلِ وَالْمَحْرُومِ. Six beats, right? However, for the verse number 24, fi amwalihim, it's a jaiz. It's not wajib. You can go up to five or six beats, or you can just stop up to four. It's up to you. وَالَّذِينَ فِي أَمْوَالِهِمْ حَقٌ مَعْلُومٌ. Correct? Can you tell me why I did not say حَقٌ مَعْلُومٌ? Rather, I said حَقٌ مَعْلُومٌ. What is the difference and why I recited حَقٌ مَعْلُومٌ?
Because we have meme after the tanween.
Aha. So حَقٌ has a tanween, right? A nun sakin